Give them the instructions to build a reactor. And Fermi and those guys says, well, a 30-foot cube, you know, 30 feet wide, deep, and high, will be big enough. So they gave that to Greenwald. He went back, and they built the reactors. They had some as-builts that nobody ever looked at. So then when B reactor went up for the first time, they got it loaded and it went up. It went up, got up a little ways, and all of a sudden it started going down. So Fermi was there and they says, what's the scoop here? The reactor's going down. No matter what we do, pulling out the rod, don't make a damn bit of difference. It's still coming down. What's in there? What's called, you know, hey, yo-yo. And we don't know how long, you know, it took like days for it to get there going, and then went back up again. So they had these little spikes short. So Fermi does his calculation, and I know what it is. Xenon. Xenon's getting generated in the reactor, absorbing neutrons. So he does a slide rule calculation, two digits of accuracy. He says, oh, damn. He says, you know, if we'd have built that reactor at 32 feet by 32 feet by 32 feet, we could, it would work. So Greenwald says, but it is 32 feet by 32 feet. They just loaded it 30 by 30. You know, they put dummies in, so the original load was just 30 by 30 by 30. So what they did then is they took the tubes out, put two more feet, you know, a slug's put it 32 feet, it went up, stayed up. All because Greenwald says 30 feet's okay, 32 feet's better.
This is what engineers need to think about.
Right, and that's what he did. He thought we'd give it a little bit extra capacity, just, you know, and it worked. But that's how close that got. Uh-huh. Had they built it originally, they'd have had B and F and D would have never made it. Mm-hmm. Those three reactors would have been too small. As it was, well, they went to 1,500 megawatts.
Now, what do you think in terms of leaving something for posterity? Both T plant and B reactor are being looked at as being of historic significance. How can we show them, keep them? What are we going to do? What would you like people? You're shaking your head, but in what way are you shaking your head?
They're too radioactive yet.
What is?
The building. At the canyon. Uh-huh. You still wouldn't let anybody in there. And to let someone in with the crane, the limited capacity of looking is so limited that I don't.
It's, yeah.
I mean, 1.5 hour. That's not my idea of 16 a day. You know, that's not my idea of a.
Perhaps a small model of it would tell as much as the building itself.
And they have that.
Yeah.
We have that. That's not a too small one. What's about that big?
Yeah. You know where that might be today? I haven't seen it.
Go to the Science Center.
Oh.
In the Federal Building? It's in their warehouse someplace.
They were the ones who had possession?
They have possession of it.
Okay. What about B reactor as far as the story you'd want people, what kind of things would you want people to walk away with? When they come to Hanford, learn what things were done.
I think the idea of complexity, that it was not a simple machine. I think people think this thing was very, very simple. It was not very simple. It took a hell of a lot of know-how. These reactor operators had to learn a hell of a lot of stuff so they could operate. There was a lot of on-hands work in the original days. Because remember, there's no computers in those days. And there was no, the interties to the monitoring system was all manual. The guys were looking at gauges. At that time, we didn't know if the neutron detectors were really correct or not. They weren't either most of the time. So these guys were watching temperature gauges on each pipe, a whole slug of things, all manual. Every shift, twice a time a shift, they would go all through the 2,500 tubes and record the temperature on the gauges. All of that kind of stuff. And that was collected by those reactor engineers trying to figure out what to do. Such things like splines and all that kind of stuff. But that didn't occur until after the computer came out and we integrated all these stuff so that, you know. Also, too, since it was so slow and it was all manual, they ended up having to have what's called a third safety system.
Right.
You know, Horta was a goal, and now we had the balls. I was there when we put the balls in.
Yeah.
And that
what
was.
What were you doing there?
I was radiation protection.
Okay.
And those went in 1953.
You're talking about when they physically put the system in, replaced the liquid tanks with the ball bearings?
Yeah, well, what happened with the liquid, the pipes let the liquid run, you know, and the graphite just got little holes, you know, so that liquid got in there and it shut the damn reactor down just about. You'd have a cold spot right in the middle anyplace. So what they did is they then pulled all that out, and they had these little balls about the size of marbles, these boron silicate balls, and they would have them in hoppers, and they would just drop. And they didn't have pipes inside the reactor. They just had a hole. Well, when we dropped the first batch of testing it, we'd say we put 6,000 balls in. God, we only got 5,600 out. There were 400 balls in there.
Ah! Each one of which reduces the output.
Yeah, just like the liquid did.
Yeah.
And, oh, God. We had to develop a method for sucking them 400 balls out.
Well, how did you get them out the first time? You sucked them out then, too.
We sucked them out with a hose, like a vacuum cleaner.
It didn't get them all.
No. So we ended up, they didn't want to put a pipe in there. But by that time, the old reactors had such large holes that a marble could go into the crack, you know, between the pieces. I mean, when they were machined, they were really flush. But by the time they had operated until 1953, which from 1944 to 1953, you know, that's 9 years. Quite a bit of the graphite had, you know, what do they call it, had come out.
Grown is the word. There was growth going on.
Well, no, that was not what happened at first. What happened at first is that the graphite was hot, and so therefore it, like, bled off. So we were getting holes. And then they finally figured out how to stop that. But when they did, all of a sudden, the graphite grew. See, but the first problem was the graphite shrank. You know, we were dissolving the graphite because remember the reactor's hot. I mean, thermally hot, quote unquote. You know, after all, we're heating up water. And almost all the moderation is being in the graphite, not in the water around the slug. We were cooling the slugs.
Moderation produces heat, right?
Right. And so that had to be fused out through the pipe, you know, the aluminum pipe, and on into the water. So the graphite was, I don't remember exactly what the temperature is, but I think they were talking about 600-700 degrees Fahrenheit, which is enough to start vaporizing some of the, you know, if you had a particular atmosphere. And it was, and that's what had generated these holes, you know, these splits, cracks, and so when they, you know, 400 marbles, it's not very many when you got 6,000, but it's a lot when you're trying to get the reactor back up.
Plus knowing every time you dump it, you might end up with yet another
more. Yeah, getting more and more and more in there.
Question, you can only suck water up 30-some feet because of air pressure only allows it to go that high.
Well, it's one atmosphere, yeah.
How do you suck up ball bearings from the bottom of the reactor? Wasn't it farther than that? It was 30
well,
feet, 40 feet?
Yeah, but see, you're using not water. You're using a high degree of air. See, you put the tube down and you squirt the air so you loosen, you know, and then you suck, you know, they drop down the ball. And you've seen them suck balls up.
But you can't suck a ball up.
With vacuum you can, huh? Well, a vacuem. You're not using a vacuum.
Yes.
You're not using a vacuum. We're pushing air up. You're pushing it up with air.
With water, that doesn't work.
Yeah, well, it would work too, because water has some force, but air is what we use.
Okay.
You wouldn't want to use water because you now get water going in there.
Right. But I'm thinking of if you have a flat column of water, you can only raise it
32 feet. That's no question, not arguing.
Bubbling up air through it, you're going to be sucking water.
Right. You're pushing air in the first place.
Right.
And that was all sealed, so you can put like 600 pounds pressure.
Wow, okay.
See?
Yeah.
There's a whole different, what you were thinking. I know what you were thinking is all, you know.
Yep.
No, that's not, you got to think about it in terms of, no, they put pressure on that baby,
yeah,
and they just blew air.
You're good. You're
Yes, right. And that just sucked them right out.
And did you end up with 6,000 or?
Well, no, we ended up with about, all told, I think that method left about 16 left.
16 balls?
Yeah, and we just burned them up.
Yeah.
You know, they've only got so much capacity, and so that was burned up in a hurry.
Okay.
So it was no big problem.
Yeah.
So
at any rate, if there is a bee reactor museum someday.
I'd love to see that.
I
love what they've got, because they've got enough parts there to show you the complication of the front end and the back end. You know, you can see all of that. The pipery, pigtails, gauges, control room. Recognizing it's not a little bitty computer. This is bank after bank after bank of non-computerized equipment, all analog. To me, I think people should see that, because our kids are growing up without an analog in their mind.
Not even with watches.
No,
yeah.
I'm digital, you know. So consequently, I think this is a piece of history that isn't that old.
Right.
And they would think it is extremely old, you know, get what I'm trying to say. I couldn't be more for it.
Good.
I'm with it. I just haven't helped for the simple reason reactor wasn't my big bag. I mean, I was in the 100 areas for 2 years, but from 1953, you know, from February of 1953 to 54,
mm-hmm.
We did the basin work. I was involved in the basin. The water runs through the reactor, then it runs through a basin and cools down thermally, and also through the short half-life radioactive material, so that by the time it gets to the back end in 30 minutes, it's not as hot, and it isn't going to hurt the river as much. The fish, we were ready. Okay, well, these basins were made out of concrete, and pretty soon the joints, you know, from expanding and contracting, you know, now it's hot, water's coming out at 200 degrees, now all of a sudden the water's cold coming out, cold. These joints expanded, cracked, you know, there's basins are 12 feet deep. So pretty soon we had holes in the, and we had as much water running out between the cracks to the river as we were getting through the main tube. So we ended up having to go in there and fill up the cracks and grout underneath the thing and stop any leaks.
You have to shut off the reactor while you're doing
that? Oh, yes, yeah. And when we were doing that, so when we were doing Ball 3X. When we were putting Ball 3X, we did the basin. So we did reactor after reactor after reactor. And I was in the 100F area, which did F, H, and D, R, and D. And then I went over to B when we did B and C. And monitoring, at that time I was monitoring. And basins got hot because if you had a rupture, before you could shut the damn thing off, something got out. Well, where did it go? It went in the basin. And then it settled out in the basin. And so we had a lot of washing to do. And
before, when you emptied it out of water, was it hot enough, not so hot that you couldn't walk down there, walk around, and take samples
you could,
and things like that?
Not at first.
Really? Okay.
Not at first. What we did the first was we hosed all the concrete off. And, you know, some of that went down in the hole, you know, you can't stop that. Anyway, we picked up all that hot water, and that went back to the tank farms. And then we, because see, there could be pieces of metal.
Sure.
See, the slug didn't necessarily have to be fresh. It could be an old piece of slug. Now you got it reading hotter than hell in little spots, reading 100,000 counts per minute. You know, and you walk on that, 3,000 is a millirem, got 35 millirem. So you couldn't walk on that. You know, 35 millirem, you can walk there 30 minutes a day. So, and that's about what they did. So they brought in 200 workers and they got to work 30 minutes each. You know, going in and pulling.
You were the person who was sitting around with a clipboard and a, you know.
No, that was the monitors. That's the guys working for me.
What were you doing?
I was their boss.
Okay.
I was looking at the readings they were taking
yeah.
when they went down to see whether we should change the time. The changing of the time was my responsibility, making sure that people didn't get overexposed.
So you're getting pressure at both ends.
Absolutely.
Like the work done, but let's not kill these guys either.
So I was the interface to the guys that are doing operations.
And theoretically, everything you did was by a book. There weren't a lot of subjective decisions to make.
Subjective decision was you don't get over 250 milliram a week for sure.
But yeah.
And if you're in a hot job like we were, you allowed them up to 50 milliram a day. And the amount of time it took to make 30 millirem, I mean 550 millirem, that's all they got to work.
So there wasn't a lot of room for discussion, really.
No. And each guy that went in, you took his time in, and you told him when the hell to get out.
Yep.
And he had a loudspeaker, and he says, okay, Joe Blow, get your butt out.
Yeah.
And you expected him out. And if he didn't get out soon enough, then he didn't go in again. Because
right.
I'd go over to the old supervisor, and I said, that guy didn't listen.
And did you find
I don't want him in there.
Would add up to kind of what you were
pretty asking? Pretty much.
Okay.
Again, there was a problem where the CP says one thing and the badge says another. So now you got to figure out what the hell's going on.
They ever wear multiple badges?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, yes. Some of them we wore like 2 days, some of them 1 day. You know, you wear one shoe.
Did you ever put any on your ankles?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you did?
Shoes,
yeah.
Inside the shoes, on the forehead, you know, in the back of the head, chest, belly, gonads, knees.
At any one time, how many?
Wrist. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven,
wow.
Eight, nine, ten.
Okay.
And you do that on the basin work. We did that for the first 3 weeks.
And so each worker could work at maybe a half hour a day.
Yeah, we said, the CP said you can work 30 minutes. So he'd wear those. And when he'd suit up underneath on the first pair of coveralls, he'd have these badges clipped to it or taped. And then he'd have another pair over the top of it and another pair over the top of that. So there's three pair of coveralls on. Because you didn't want him to get contaminated. Because decontaminated badges is bad news, because that's radiation close. That just screws up the whole radiation reading. So we wanted to make damn sure. And then when it was wet, then we wore wetsuits, a few things like that. Getting ready took longer, and going out took longer than it was to work.
Yeah.
So that much I can tell you.
How quickly would you get the badge readings back? The next day, or?
We could get the reading next day.
You were pretty comfortable with the results?
No, we wear them, generally speaking, for the test that we did with the 10 badges, we would wear them with the badge that he wore.
Oh, right.
So that we had a reference point
right.
to all these 10 measurements.
Correlation.
And that's, otherwise you can't correlate. Also, too, remember now this badge system isn't necessarily, quote unquote, that accurate at low doses. So you wanted to have enough dose on there to where you could have reasonable accuracy. And since the guy was taking 50 milliram per day, in a week's time, he got 250. So 250 is a very good reading on a film badge. You know, you could good statistics. You could get a good feeling as to what his body was getting.
So you took the 10 badges and then looked at the single badge that was being worn by the same person and said, well, it looks like when this badge reads this much, his feet were getting this much, his chest was getting this much.
Okay, feet, arms, and feet can get 10 times what the body can get. So now, is this job going to be limiting to the hands,
mm-hmm.
or is this job going to be limiting to the body?
Right.
And the only way you know that is to put on the extremities.
Yeah, and the feet especially in that case.
Well, also he's playing with hands, so you don't know if he's kneeling.
Right.
So therefore the knees, you know.
Because yeah.
These guys do all kinds of dumb things.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to stop them from working. You know, they might go down, they might be on their knees. So
yeah.
So we had to correlate. And you had to be sure that you weren't going to say, well, hell, he's burning out his legs before he gets 250. Maybe he's going to get to the legs 300. You know, you can't do that. So you say, hey, you got to stop. We're only going to let you get 30 because you're limiting to the feet. You get what I'm trying to say? So even though the whole body said it was you're well within limits, extremity dose, and see, an extremity dose went down into the records also. You know, that's also been recorded for these people. That's in the guy's file.
Yeah. Because you had the badges on them.
Right. Whatever decimeter reading we ever put on a guy, that's been recorded in his file.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that were, and we were developing those kinds of thoughts because no one had ever done the basin work before. Also, too, little things like when we were on the concrete ones, we always kept everything wet. So when they weren't working there, we had a spray system.
Just for dust? Keep the dust in?
We keep the concrete wet. And I'll tell you why.
Oh, physically just to keep it
wet so that it can't move. In sea basin, metal basin, they weren't careful. And one Saturday, we had a whirlywig, and we crapped up beer.
You mean it just blew the stuff out?
It sucked it right on. And spread it over the countryside. So we went out one Saturday. That's when we found the particle problem from West area. That problem started in the 100 areas.
Really?
Because we had a dry basin. And the 100 areas, when the workers came in on the fivefold, the all of a sudden, wow, the patrolman coming in, we're setting the fivefold off. And they shouldn't have, you know, coming to work. So they called us up, and so we sent a crew out there, and sure enough, some particles all over. So we started then trying to delineate this problem. So as we were moving away from V area, it was getting lighter and lighter and lighter, less and less specks. And we're going down the railroad. And when we were going from V area, say, to 2 West area, Susie Q Junction. We got to Susie Q Junction, it was kind of clean. So the guy said, well, hell, let's go another half mile. So he went down another half mile. Lo and behold, started going up. Now, if the source is C,
right.
What's it doing hotter over there? And as we got toward west, got more and more and more, higher and higher and higher. So he says, well, all right, we'll take a carload of guys and we'll go over to 2 West area. So we drove over there with 6 guys of us, and I had one guy that hadn't gotten out of the car yet. He turned his instrument on, put the probe on the ground, 10,000 counts per minute. So that's how we discovered the C-stack, you know, the redox pile, the redox, the ruthenium problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we delineated that day, and then we were totally confused. Because, see, a GM doesn't tell you what the radiation is coming from, it just tells you activity. And it wasn't until we had, at that time, 256 channel analyzer, was a big thing. There were only 2 on the plant, one in the 189D and one down 300 Aaron. So now we had to take samples, and we took them, and turns out that like ruthenium is a beta emitter, so we're getting like bremsstrahl on a very low energy type thing. But the 100 area stuff gave us a spectra, fission product, yeah. So it took us, then we delineated the whole problem, then we had all 50 to 100 monitors 3 feet apart and straight ahead, and every time they found a speck, the guy from J. Jones would go over with a shovel and pick it up, put it in the bucket.
The specks were from redox or from
redox and from the two we picked them both up.
Okay. But it was specks, it was not covering the ground.
No, it was a little flecks, you know, because it's like dirt. Little, you know, the stuff kind of sticks to something else. Or it was a liquid, it got absorbed in a solid material, you know, that's it. So there were lots of things happened, and whose fault was it? Well, too damn late to worry about that. Well, it just don't want to happen again. You had your investigations, and then you modified your procedures, and this is how things got done.
It was a new industry.
Yes. We never had clean basins before. Hadn't cleaned a metal basin before. And that dried out faster than the concrete.
I wonder why.
Well, it's metal. Carbon, right? Yeah, that's why it stayed, but it stayed wet.
Oh, damn. Yeah,
damn. Okay. Stayed wet. Where the stuff would have stayed down, and the air probably wouldn't have sucked that light particle up, because it would have been tied with water. See, after that, boy, it was underneath 2 inches of water. And water running down the sides and all that kind of stuff. It increased the cost of doing the job, but it should have, because we can't afford the risk of letting things get away from us. That takes us away from T-Plan.
Well, it actually is closer to the reactor, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
Because people, you know, there wasn't much radiation in the normal coolant water, but over years and years of operation, stuff had settled out, right?
Well, it was from the particulate coming from the ruptures.
Right.
It was the ruptures that were
going. Pure water in itself will come out.
Pure water, and if there's no rupture, it'll stay warm. It will be hot in the sense that you've activated the oxygen and nitrogen. But see, that's a short half-life material, and so by the time it gets 30 minutes, it's gone. And that's like 10, 15, 20 half-lives. You know, anything that goes more than 10, 20 half-lives is pretty much gone. And it's not that high to start with. You know, you're talking about a couple thousand counts per minute. So what went back to the river was really low, except when you had a rupture. There are no filters no filters out there. At least there weren't then. I don't think there's any now. When a rupture, but see, now we have such fast equipment that.
You mean in a regular reactor?
Yeah.
Such as if the primary coolant ruptured into the secondary.
Well, no.
Something like that.
That when we could handle. But even then, you had to stop, you know, you had the water flow. It has to go through, most of that flow, a rupture, would have gone through the cooling water and goes right down to the basin and out she goes. And as far as I know, there's no filter on that. And I don't think it would have caught these small particles anyway.
Well, it would have been.
You can't drive 55,000 gallons, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Just can't drive that through a HEPA filter.
And change it every hour.
Yeah. So, does that make any sense?
Oh yeah, it all makes sense, it's all good, and I think before we burn you out completely, you have your burnout and how long you can talk, you know, but it's all relevant. You know, right now we're looking at T-Plant, some of the things that happened there, so a lot of the things you talked about were great for that, but the work at the reactor with the Ball 3X and the basins is, it's the first time I've talked to somebody who worked on cleaning out the basins, so that was interesting.
Well, there were a lot of things.
Yeah.
I was very lucky because I got to move. I got into the
everybody
places.
Everybody did. I don't know anybody who had one job for like 20 years.
No.
Certainly not in the early days.
No, not during time of operation.
Yeah.
Most you were allowed to stay in any one place a year, except when I went to 2345. I stayed for 1954 to 1958.
Did they encourage you to move around now?
Oh, absolutely. They wanted you to be able to go any place.
Yeah.
And since I'd been in 100 areas, they didn't hesitate to call me if they had a problem out there to whip me out there. And
so that must have been the security issues of not letting anybody learn too much about any particular process. That was less of an issue then.
Hold on for a minute. I got to.
I took it off.
Okay, great.
All right. It is for me.
I wish we had more opportunity to do it in a more relaxed, you know, sort of an ongoing thing with other people too. It's because otherwise, you know, you spend your whole life in this career, and now we're asking for this much of it.
Yeah, and pretty much.
You're getting just a little tip of the sample of it.
And there's no way, I don't think there's any way that we can give it all to you in any way.
Some people like to write their autobiographies. Some people go teach a class. But otherwise, there's no direct ongoing way to.
See, for instance, like the first and third Wednesday of every month that the monitors meet. Guys that I used to work with.
Yeah, like Bob is there.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And these guys have that early knowledge because they're all retirees. And they all had come in either most of the guys had come in about 1949. Prior to that, it was the guys that were management were then down monitoring.
Right.
In my early years, I had an instrument in my hand a lot. If we were really deeply concerned about the radiation problems in that, I went in. I wouldn't let my monitors go in.
Mm-hmm.
Up until 58, at which time then the union had come in and only the monitors could monitor, and we had a setback. But I was allowed to go to 58. And the reason for that is because I had been in 2345 milling a long time. And we had interesting monitoring problems. Secondly, I was working on monitoring problems, the doses associated with taking instrument reading, and now what's the dose? Coming up with rules of thumb. I worked on that. Also, too, I was involved in investigations. And no one had more incidents than we had in the 200 areas. Was profound. Whether it happened at Redox or T plant or 2345, 231, or at B plant or pure, you know, it was all. I mean, and there was a lot going on, a lot we were learning, and from investigating. And then you didn't always get the truth from everybody when they told you, "Well, I did this, I did that." You had to kind of figure out, "No, that's not the way it was, the way it really was." And then after you tell them the way it was, then they'd finally say, "Yeah, that's the way it was." But it sometimes took quite a bit of effort to because people are naturally defensive. You know, it's their job. Yeah, they got involved, and no one wants to admit to a mistake. I don't care who it is, whether today's world is no different. And it was hard to get some of these things out. We had lots of interesting incidents, you know, like a piece of plutonium in the guy's arm. That's in the, had a guy put his hand in the bottom of TTPA solution to plutonium and went right through the glove and everything, right into his hand, you know, millions of deep per m. Days and days where he never went home, obviously.
Yeah.
Millions of deep per m. I was involved in all of, I got pulled off my regular assignment to also build analog models to see how well DDTA works, EDTA, DTPA, how well these things work in terms of removing things that were causing confusion.
There wasn't anywhere to go for the books, right?
You know, we were writing it. We were writing it. We were writing it. And no one knew how much to give. You know, if I give how much, what can I expect? And from the very meager data that we had, and the very meager number of cases we had, we developed models that have held up very well, held up for 40 years. So the work we did wasn't that bad. I think personally we did very good work. I think the guys that I worked with were sterling.
Yeah.
Oh God, I tell you, I guess it was the right people at the right time. Really, truly, it was. I'm very proud of the record we've got when you think we didn't know anything and we never killed anybody. And the guys that we could have hurt, you know, the guys with the heavy incident, you know, the heavy incidents, not too many of those died, say, like from leukemia or anything like that. Most of them died heart. And not at young ages, 79, 80, all of this kind of stuff. And those that did die from things that they've been compensated, as far as I know. They might have had to go to court and all that, but nevertheless, I don't think we've been very belligerent about it. So it's just, I don't know.
It's interesting because every industry has a fatality factor, right? And you guys were starting out an industry that had no track record. And looking back is how you go and
compare
to other industries, other chemical industries, heavy industries.
Yeah. We're the only industry that I know that has, since people aren't dying right from the amount of radiation they got, based on epidemiology, that we have healthy workers. And they predicated that as because we got our physicals. And we got monitored, and so consequently we must have seen things early, and so therefore they didn't die. The alternative to that is that maybe, fellas, they didn't get as much radiation as you thought they got.
Yeah.
You know, that's an alternative. Maybe we weren't healthier than anybody else. I don't think we were. And just because we were getting medical doesn't necessarily mean we aren't dying from heart, stroke, or everything else, just like everybody else is. So, but how do you prove that we didn't have as much radiation as they're putting in the files? So I worked with Ethel Gilbert for 5 years, who was the epidemiologist for the plant, who said we should have so many deaths, and Jack Fix is now that guy that has that. I worked for him. And we proved, or I proved, I thought, that the amount of neutron, fast neutron dose that was given to our employees was considerably less than what they've got on the file. Yeah. because they automatically added 50 millirem per week neutrons to every worker, operator, pipe. Yeah, it's just a boogie factor. And that's what makes our numbers look so big. Mm. See, the number of the amount of neutrons exceeds the gamma. And that's not possible. And that's where I came from. That's the safety factor to give you the best estimate of how many people should be dying by when, right. What.
Okay.
And see, okay, you say, well, we should be getting so many deaths. Well, damn it, they're not dying. Now what? Well, they said we have a safety factor, healthy employees, when in truth, maybe your estimate of exposure is a little bit high.
The other alternative is that the radiation is good for you.
That's an alternative which many of us in health physics have indicated, because for the simple reason, background is 300 millirem per year from the sun, from the ground. And so you ask yourself, if we're getting 300 millirem, you know, and that has, we've been having that since birth, even before birth, is that injuring us? Are we any dumber than the ape man was? Quote unquote, 10,000 years, 100,000 years. Everything was higher then than it is now. Because now things decayed, you know. Every 94,000 years is a half-life. Or 10, whatever the uranium, 238, I think it's quite a bit, but 2345. So you ask yourself these questions and you come up with, you know, you wonder whether people aren't better off.
Do things like bacteria have the same susceptibility to radiation as a human cell?
Yes. That's fundamentally bacteria are one cell.
Okay.
And so therefore...
It's not as if you're perhaps killing off bacteria before you're hurting yourself.
No. You're getting mutants, so they're getting used to... I can believe that. But I think we're generating more mutants via the chemical route than we are ever with radiation. Personally, that just... And the reason for that is... 10 to the 10th photons per centimeter squared is a rad. Okay? That's 10 to the 10th. Now let's go back. How many atoms or molecules are there in a molecular weight? And it's 6 times 10 to the 23rd. Okay, so I can't see a millionth. Well, so I'll be generous. A billionth. One part in a billion is what? Take 9 from 10 to the 20, from 23, you get 14. That's still four orders of magnitude higher than one rad. So therefore, chemically, bigger numbers. One part per million is 10 to the 17th kinds of things. We're talking about 10 to the 10, which is a rad, and we're talking about 0.3 a year. You get the idea of the chemical, in my judgment, is much more fearsome or fearing.
Yeah.
Due to the fact that 7 orders of magnitude or 10 orders of magnitude, different, higher. And so therefore, that's a much more severe problem. Am I? Give you a corollary. To me, I find 10 to the 10th a pretty good sized number. This is what my, am I making sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there's also the fact, though, that we're exposed to chemicals every day of our life in every situation.
That we're willing to accept, just like we're willing to accept 55,000 deaths on the highway. And that's per year, see? So there's a funny sense of value.
What do you think it is that put nuclear, all things nuclear, in the light that they're in today?
Fear of the unknown. None of us people could get up in front of a hearing, a Senate hearing, and say, will one rad, how much hurt will that give? Can't tell you. You know, they can tell you what a mile of road will do, but you can't tell you what a rad is going to do.
But that mile of road is only based on statistics from what happened the year before.
Right.
It's not like a physical thing.
Right, and we couldn't, and see, even though you haven't had an incident, you start with epidemiology and you play games. A case in point is the reactor incident in New York, you know, where the reactor blew up. And they're arguing, two PhDs, they're arguing whether it caused a half a death or a whole death.
Yeah. Statistically, yeah.
Yeah. I rest my case. And these arguments get raged in the papers, scare the hell out of everybody.
I presume the same thing is going to be happening with genetically engineered things, for better or worse, for right or wrong.
I don't think so.
You don't think people are going to be real worried about it?
Nope. Oh. If they were, there would be upheaval in the... There's no upheaval in the... Not like there was against nuclear. 56, starting in 56, my God, anti-nuclear was... Ralph Nader was in the paper every day.
But it wasn't nuclear reactors back then, was it? It was
nuclear. He sure as hell did go after. Well, yeah, but see, they equated everything to bomb. There was nothing but a bomb. You didn't have a reactor. That didn't mean anything.
It was just a controlled bomb.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bomb. It was a bomb. You know, everything was bomb, 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 bomb. Nuclear power. They wouldn't hardly let us build any reactors in the United States. I think we have, what, about 10, 12? France has about 30. You know, they're tweaking their nose at all of us and saying, go ahead, let them price the gasoline get high. We don't care. We're going to build another 6 reactors. And they've operated now for 50 years. And they're doing really fine. Our reactors have done fine. I mean, the worst criticality incident we had might have caused a half a death. Maximum, a one death. Now, is that something to be outrageously feared?
No.
How many reactor years have we got? We must have, by now, we must have 300-400 years of reactor years of experience. And we're not even thinking about.
But when you started, did you feel like you were getting into the industry that was going to be replace oil industry? I mean, was it?
No. That didn't happen until... We never went into those kinds of things until 1956. For instance, when Eisenhower, he had the Atoms for Peace program, where we gave away 500 reactors, you know, swimming pool type reactors. Gaddafi got 3 of them at 100 kilowatts, which is 2 bombs a year for those people who... If you want to see something interesting, Dan Rather had a special one time in which he was reporting at how many airplanes had been left in the desert. We didn't need them, you know, B-24s and B-17s.
And during what period?
After World War II.
Just left
them there. It wasn't, didn't pay to bring them back. Mm-hmm. The thing that was interesting is all of the tails are missing. You know, the part that rises?
Yeah.
Here you got 300 airplanes on the deck, and not one of them's got a tail. I looked at that. Well, that's strange. And then I read the Washington State law, which allows Boeing Airplane Company to put 1,500 pounds of uranium into the tail of a 47, 500 pounds in a 707. Didn't you know that?
Just for balance?
Yeah, because, see, uranium weighs speed G of 19. Lead's only 11. So with the same volume, I almost get twice as much weight. And you don't have that much space. However, that it's only depleted uranium. So we're getting rid of that big pile of depleted uranium. Yes. However, what is depleted uranium?
It's uranium that's been through a reactor or a separation process.
And what's the primary nucleon?
238.
Beautiful. And what is 238? It's the mother atom of plutonium. If I put a neutron into 238, it goes uranium 239, beta goes up, and becomes plutonium 239. Ah! So we let 500 airplanes with 500 pounds, 300 airplanes with 500 pounds of uranium go to Gaddafi. I'm sure that he can put them through a roller and make quarter inch thick uranium sheets and line 17 foot pool reactors with that. And let all the neutrons
simmer.
Yeah, and let it sit. Who the hell cares? And, you know, Then every once, well, maybe once a year or once every 2 years, you'll take that out, put another sheet in there, and then go over to a laboratory with a little hood and dissolve that baby up. And one of the, and the chemistry of plutonium is well known by everybody. I mean, if Russia's got it, Gaddafi's got it. So the guys, he doesn't have to steal plutonium from the Israelis. Just like the Israelis didn't steal it from anybody else. They made their own. So how can you keep, with 500 reactors out there, how can you keep plutonium not from happening to people?
Yeah.
Anyway, that happened to us. Once we knew that those reactors were going against our judgment, because Eisenhower says, no, we want to let everybody have the nuclear, and because we want them to make the measurements on metal fatigue and so on and so on. Sounded good, but you buy this problem, which we did, which we have. And anyway, I helped write state law.
You helped what?
Write the state law for us being an agreement state.
Which state law?
Washington State.
About what?
Nuclear.
Oh.
Go read it. It's down in the library.
Yeah.
I think it's 208 or something like that. And then you go back in there and you look at what they can put into an airplane. And there's a whole bunch of little things in there that scare the hell out of you. You know, for a guy who's been in radiation protection.
Yeah.
So that's
interesting. It's a whole tangent I hadn't imagined.
Yeah, well, you're not, you've never been in the field.
No.
And so you wouldn't, would you ask a question? No. I've given you more information than the questions you've asked, because they're interesting little aspects that go with this whole thing. They're not necessarily good for the tea plant.
Well, and the other thing is, me asking questions might be not what's interesting or important about the things you've done. You know, I might be asking questions that don't really relate to you, too. So I think that I always do better if I shut up a bit and let people
talk
about the things they're comfortable about or interested in or find important.
Yeah, and all of us have had, like you say, had interesting careers. There isn't hardly any guy that you'll talk to that hasn't felt that he did a good job, at least in radiation protection.
Now, do you have any friends who quit because they didn't think it was safe?
Oh, yes.
Or didn't like the management?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Lots. We brought in 500 chemists, and we lost 75 the first year. Once they found, as soon as they found out what the hell was here, they didn't want any part of it. Nuclear bombs. Had a good friend who no longer could do the job that I ended up getting after he left, signing off on all those weapons.
Oh, not for.
Like, for instance, an H-bomb. That's so hellaciously large. And that's not against just military. That has to be against civilian population.
What military installation
is that big, yeah. you know.
New York City is that
big. Yeah, right. And so you get rid of the backup for the military, which is the people. And that's what H-bomb. And it's so hellaciously large that you've ruined your political system if you drop it. I mean, you know, you drop 7 bombs on Russia, and you haven't got enough big cities left or enough politicians left to do anything. And if you let those people, if you warn them, and then you destroy the city after they're out, what do you do with all these locusts? I mean, you have anarchy. So there isn't anybody that I know of in political system that is so paranoid that would use a weapon. The reason they won't is because, like Gaddafi, he's only got 3 cities. And he hasn't got anything left. I mean, what's he going to be ruler of? Mm-hmm. You know, so you drop 9 bombs on America, and you've got like 75 million people. What are you going to do with 75 million people out in the countryside?
Now, would somebody have stayed here working at 2, 3, 4, 5, if they were adamantly against nuclear weapons and the policy of having nuclear weapons?
Yeah. But I didn't meet too many of those. The only one I met was one guy who was signing off when he realized how many weapons there were. The number was so large, it was so mind-boggling that to build any more, he thought it was, you know, crazy.
And politically, you were still comfortable with the, with what was going on?
Well, we were...
Reasonable approach?
I felt much more comfortable once we had the H-bomb. Because, see, the A-bomb is small enough to where it could be a tactical weapon. And we built a lot of cannon shells. But there's no... H-bomb's a whole different thing. And if you ever escalate, my God, I would assume the political boys would take care of it.
So you thought that the sheer lunacy of even trying to use one...
The sheer lunacy of going against America with 30,000 weapons... It's lunacy. Even if you figure on getting 90%,
right. Still not a.
It's crazy, and just we can't afford to go against Russia even with 6,000. I mean 60. What are we going to do with against 60 or 600? I mean it's crazy.
You would have more deaths, civilian and otherwise, in the first half hour of the war.
You would no longer have any capability, in my judgment, of attacking further. You know, there's no way you can invade us. Nor can we invade them. Because there isn't enough, there's too much anarchy. There's just no law and order. I don't care what anybody says.
So you thought it was a reasonable approach to international...
Yeah, the bigger the pile was, the better I liked it. Because now, I don't care, even a little paranoia stops you from using it. You no longer had to worry about large paranoia. Just even a little bit, any sane man, even a sane man is scared, much less a paranoid. That's the way I thought. I've let my views be known, and you agree or not agree, but that's the way I felt. It just didn't make sense. There aren't 600 targets out there or 6,000 targets out in this world. There just aren't. And then when people started talking about China, I went to China 25 years ago, admittedly. But I was worried. But there's no way in hell China can do anything. I mean, what can they do with a sandpan? You know, sure they got 7,000 or 10,000 sandpans, but they aren't going to be able to come across the ocean. I mean, remember when they invaded Vietnam? Maybe that was before your time. After we left Vietnam, China went to invade Vietnam. And they got 7 miles into the country and couldn't go any further. And you know why? The single transportation that they had was a single railroad line that were bringing supplies from 1,000 miles back out to the front. So when they sent a soldier to the front, he had a knapsack, okay, full of whatever the hell he put in there. Well, he can't put a ton in there. I mean, if he puts 90 pounds in there for a little guy like that, he's got a lot. Okay, how much food is that? How much ammunition is that? Et cetera. How long will he last? A week? 10 days? 15 at the most. Then what does he do? Then you got to retreat. And that's exactly what happened. So they put... remember the Tiananmen Square fiasco? Well, I was in Peking. A few years before that, and give you an example of a problem. When I was there, there were two filling stations in Peking for the military vehicles and for everything else. During the day, the military vehicles were loaded with foodstuffs, which they brought into town and dropped off, and the people then picked it up at the display. And then the military, at night then, could go out, pick up soldiers, and bring them in. Well, how many, I think they had like 15, 20 trucks, one-ton trucks. Well, how many guys can you pick up with 25 trucks till you can get an army of 10,000 guys? Takes weeks. And if you recall, they were running around Tiananmen Square for weeks before they finally quelled them. And that's because it took them that long to get the 10,000 GIs in there to do that. So you can, to me, China is not a threat. I don't, they're a threat in terms of nuclear, but they're sure not a threat. Now, if they can blow us out of the world, okay, then, you know, that's a threat. But, and they've, now they may be the ones who might use a nuclear weapon with a rocket.
Theoretically, I mean, the theory that anybody who understands them well enough and knows how to use them offensively would never do it against somebody who has equal weapons.
No. And they're even more conservative than we are. So, anyway, I...
You can't be a world power without it. That's
right, right.
You don't feel like you're part of the big boys unless you do have that capability.
Right,
whether
right.
France or
England
or China.
So, anyway... I've gone to these countries just to see what you know what's there. To give an example, inside of Peking, there are two roads, four lanes, one going east and west, and one going north and south. And as soon as you get to the edge of the city, now how do you know you're at the edge of the city? Because that's the last house, which is a high-rise apartment. And then it's a two-lane highway. And how do I know that was a two-lane highway? Because we went to the China Wall. Mm-hmm. So we went out north and went to the China Wall. And then when we came in, we were going to go to the coastline. As soon as we got out of the south end, it was a two-lane highway. And if you want to see how they made the road down at Kualin, which is way down south, they were making it in three-foot squares. And they had a manual tamper like we have, you know, and a 3 foot square that big was all that that half ton truck could hold. So they made it in 3 foot square. Can you imagine going down the highway, and I was looking at this, and there's this quilt of 3 foot squares. And when I saw that, I couldn't imagine it until I asked somebody. I said, what is this? And he says, well, that's, so each truckload, give it 3 foot square, so the next truck. When I saw all of that, I says, why worry? We've got enough power, no one's gonna attack. We will not use it because there aren't enough targets anyplace. And if you notice all of the stuff, they've always stayed with explosives.
Did what?
Everybody's almost stayed with explosives, TNT, plastic. They've stayed away from nuclear.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, in 50 years, huh?
Yeah.
There's never been an occasion to use one.
The only nuclear material we've ever used against anybody was when we were at the Gulf War.
Oh, with depleted uranium.
You depleted shells. Uranium shells. Oh, I was upset when I heard that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Just because the it's not a good metal to be breathing in, or
you're spreading uranium all over hill.
Oh, uranium that could be useful to somebody.
Yeah, my feeling is I've got these 5 million shells. I mean, we've given them a gift.
Yeah.
Does he have to steal anything? No. Idi Amin isn't, you know, the guy is not an ignorant guy.
Can you buy uranium on the open market?
No.
Regulated or?
Well, read the state law, and I'll give you a hint. After the second, third resale value of an airplane, it's no longer controlled.
The airplane is new, and then it's sold used.
And then sold used, and sold used again. And when that happens, it's no longer regulated, no longer put on the books.
Yeah.
So then you, and if you go to some of these small airports, you will see 707s with tails missing.
No, watch for it.
Watch for it when you're in these foreign countries. There they sit on the air.
How many pounds do they put in?
500.
Oh, okay.
It's an appreciable amount. You don't have to. I mean, that'll make quite a bit of quarter inch thick sheeting. Thermal neutrons will not go through more than a quarter inch.
And is it depleted uranium only because it's more valuable for other uses when it's not depleted?
Well, 235.
Or is it that they won't sell real uranium in a metallic version?
Well, they sell regular uranium all the time. That's in the open market. There's a uranium market in the world.
But
Depleted.
Why did they use depleted in the back?
Well, because we have this big warehouse full of it, you know, that's about 17 miles long and 8 miles wide. That's
really? Okay.
You know, where we sucked out the 0.35%.
Yep.
And made reactor material, you know, at 5%, so. Well, and then what do you do with the reactor material that you rerun? You know, we're such a rich nation that we have not yet, at this point in time, redissolved a single slug that's gone through a power reactor.
That's right. Let alone taking depleted uranium, mixing in plutonium, and saying, hey, we got fuel again.
Yeah. It's,
and we have no plans to recycle fuel, huh?
Not that I... Yeah, we're going to deep bury it.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Have you at all read about what they do in France with their fuel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Is it...
They're recycling.
How modern or different is it from what you were doing here?
Not any more modern than we've proposed, which we already know all about, because we've done all the preliminary... We've done all the chemistry.
Oh, the one that was going to be back east? That was the one they were going to build?
Yeah. Well, France has, I think, three of them.
Okay, they ship hot fuel around to various plants.
No. They remake it.
No, but they ship it from the reactor
to a separation plant.
Yeah.
Yes, and then you remake it. And see, what people don't understand is that plutonium that's in there is really much better than the plutonium that we've got, because our plutonium is weapons grade.
Right.
But if you want a reactor grade plutonium, you want something that has maybe like 50% 240.
You like that?
Yeah, because when it splits, when it hits a neutron, see, instead of giving you, uranium is 1.4 neutrons, I think, per event.
Per fission.
Yeah. And plutonium is, I think, 1.9, 239. 240, I think, is 2.6. So now you get 1.6 atoms of plutonium back for every atom used.
Mm-hmm.
Ha! Ha! I mean, the breeder concept is here to stay. Not only, now every ton of uranium becomes a ton of plutonium, and the MeV is enormous, 9.3 MeV per event. Oh, God.
It's a whole different kind of energy production than we've ever had before.
Yeah, well... When in the 50s, when we went through the mathematics of it, we said that we have enough uranium on hand at that time, just the uranium part, that we'd have 400 years with a 2% growth per year, you know, where we go to reactors. And if we went the breeder concept, we have no idea how much. I mean, it's like having 10,000 oil fields. Because now instead of 0.35% of the uranium going into plutonium atoms, you know, stop talking about the whole works. And 0.235 is something like a factor of 300. So now 400 years times 300, you know, you say to yourself, well, and that's without the newfound uranium, without, you know, it's such a large number that I guess people didn't believe it, you know. At least Americans didn't. So, it's just a... No, I quit studies. I stopped worrying about studies in 67. By that time, we had done all the laser work.
Mm-hmm.
We had done all the recovery. We already had the classification. We had the monoliths with making it into a great big monolith of concrete. And if you didn't want, you know, which way do you want to go with what levels? There were two other methods for making little glass balls. So there was a whole bunch of methods that we had developed all here.
How much waste was there going to be, or is there, in France from a modern, efficient recycling of hot fuel?
Each reactor produces a tube of material 17 feet long and 1 foot in diameter per year.
A tube of unusable material?
Of fission products.
Not plutonium?
Not plutonium and not uranium.
Which you know you can take out and reuse. 17 feet long and how big are
1 foot in diameter.
And that would be very hot stuff?
Not necessarily. Because you've also taken out strontium and you've also taken out the cobalt.
I wonder if they're doing that in France.
Yes. Yes, yes.
Okay.
They're using the technology we developed in the 60s.
Yeah.
I can tell you that right now. Separations plant is pure X plant.
And do they have a permanent waste storage for the stuff?
Yes, they do.
Okay.
Yes, they do. But remember now, these old slugs, these old 17 foot long, some of them are innoxious almost. They've been around 25 years.
Right.
So after 25 years, as far as I'm concerned, that's no longer a problem. But you leave it where it's at. It's not that big a deal. So they're, I think they've got, 30 reactors, so they get 30 of these tubes per year. I mean, you know, if you can put them in the ground, and if they're not generating enough heat anymore, especially the old ones, you don't need to even hardly do anything with them, you know, a little bit of water cooling in that system, do it all, you know, to a pipe.
And was there any talk 25 years ago about getting the tanks emptied out in the 200 areas?
Oh yes. That's when we talked about getting the bismuth and the aluminum and all that type of thing.
But they never took the time or the money to set up a system of doing it.
We did all the preliminary work, I call it test tube work.
Mm-hmm.
So we know what the reaction, we know what it takes to do it. Yes. So deep geological storage was just the enigma. I mean, that was crazy. Crazy, crazy, crazy. All that uranium.
Yeah.
And that's all 5%. And we haven't burned 5%.
Oh, in a modern reactor.
In a modern reactor, it's 5% uranium-235.
So it's still more enriched than natural uranium.
Oh, absolutely, by at least 10 orders of magnitude. I mean, at least an order of magnitude.
So if you just pull out the uranium isotopes and all, you end up with something that's more enriched than.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
And there's how many thousands of tons waiting to be buried?
Oh Jesus.
Yeah.
I mean.
Interesting.
I'm sorry. That's it's crazy. We're such a rich country, we don't need to do that.
Right. And oil is not so expensive yet.
No, oil's not very high yet. Power's not high yet. Did you know that some of the cheapest power shortly is going to be whoops by it?
Yeah.
Well, because we were not satisfied until we had put a penalty on the hydroelectric power plants of $500 million per year. That's how much the fish are costing us right now. So right now, they can't sell power from the dams, which cost roughly, I think, 1.6 cents kilowatt, or maybe a tenth of that. But it now costs 5.4 cents. And we can make power out here. I know what it costs, 4.6. So the nuclear power right now is cheaper than dam power. And gas power is now going to be about 12 cents. Maybe 18 cents. I don't know. I haven't seen the latest numbers on the BTUs. Same with oil. You know. See, oil doesn't have to pay the tax. They're burning $24 a barrel type thing. They're not paying like we are, $3 a gallon, you know. So all of that is in that library out there. I can tell you that now, because all of those became documents that we wrote, and then we used to go to meetings, because you know the health physics was kind of interested in going to nuclear power. Because after all, that was our future, because we knew ultimately that these reactors were going to shut down. And so for the monitors and the workers to work, they were going to have to go to reactors. And so our future was in private power, you know, private nuclear power. So we obviously, as a since that's the kind of thing that health physicists, I mean, they don't need, you don't need them, except in nuclear plants and separation plants. You know, uncanny. So, consequently, they wanted to have all of the reasons why power should be coming on. So, anyway, that's.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting how if we can move off in other directions so easily. I like that.
Remember that we worked on all of that really early. You know, people always say, well, you haven't heard Nader say anything in the last 10 years against nuclear power. He doesn't dare because he's got to read 70,000 documents. And lawyers are notoriously famous for reading about two or three, and that's it.
Were you looking forward to retirement when the time came?
Yeah, I'd spent 44 years.
Yeah.
That was long enough. I think it was time for guys like me to go away and let the young guys.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't have any problem with that.
Yeah. Still enjoy living in Richmond?
Oh, absolutely. There's no traffic.
That's right.
Short
you
distance.
You don't realize it until you go anywhere else. Right?
I just came from Phoenix, 1.5 million people. Like I said, 100 blocks took me 45 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, I can drive to Pasco in 15.
But why do you need to go to Pasco?
Yeah, right? But I'm saying, yeah.
To find a reason to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I laugh. I'm self-employed, so I work at home, and I put 3,000 miles a year in my car.
Yeah.
And
so it hardly pays to buy a new one.
No, it doesn't. Not at all.
No, yeah, not with that.
It's
you're rusting through just from sitting.
Right. So, no, it's easy to live around here.
Oh, yeah.
How long have you been in this house?
1965. Had it built. First owner. We had lots of first owners here. There's only about three of us left.
Yeah.
You'd expect that.
I'm going to turn this off now.
Go ahead.